The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on Twitter to join these conversations live. And check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets. And now, on to our Lead Lag Live discussion hosted by Michael Guyon.
My name is Michael Guyon, publisher of the Lead Lag Report. Joining us for the hour, Kevin Wadsworth of North Star Bad Charts, which is an interesting name for a domain we'll get into. But Kevin, for those who are not familiar with you, I know you've got a pretty strong background in technicals, but I want you to talk about who you are, how'd you get involved in markets, and what are you doing with North Star?
Hi, Michael. Hi, everybody. So my background is 34 years as a meteorologist. So I'm, to all intents and purposes, a scientist. And my career has been spent forecasting the future in terms of the planet's atmosphere, really. So atmospheric dynamics. Predicting the future in the world of meteorology relies on high-powered supercomputers, which simulate what's going on in the atmosphere and project into the future what's going to happen. And it was during the course of my career that I spotted a lot of similarities in predicting the future with that kind of thing, and predicting the future in anything else for that matter. And the techniques that are used, meteorology and weather forecasting, are directly applicable to any other type of prediction technique. So, and like many people, you know, I'm very interested in investing. And during the market downturns during the early 2000s and 2008 in particular, 2007, 2008, became very interested in what my investments were doing or not doing, and decided to try and start applying some of my skills and techniques in forecasting, in particular in assessing the probabilities of future outcomes, which is how we do our weight of evidence-based analysis. North Star Bad Charts is a combination of myself, North Star, on Twitter, and my friend and colleague, Patrick Karim, who is at BadCharts1 on Twitter. So we combined forces, and North Star Bad Charts is where we are now with our website and everything else.
It sounds very good cop, bad cop. Just for, there's a North Star, I bet. But hold on. So I think this is kind of interesting. This will be an interesting discussion, because I've often made the analogy that when it comes to markets, you basically have to view yourself like a weatherman, like a meteorologist, in the sense that you have to assess conditions. The conditions get you to the probabilities. The probabilities get you to the outcome, right?
Exactly.
So as much as a forecast is one possible outcome based on higher probabilities, My point when I bring up that analogy is that too many people focus on the quote-unquote call, whereas in reality, you have to identify the weather.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, really anybody that's been in this game for long enough begins to realize that the future is never set in stone. And for any analyst to try and pretend that it is, and that there is just one outcome that's coming our way, well, really, you need to tune out of that person's views and opinions, really, because that's completely and utterly wrong. And peering into the future, it's a little bit like trying to put together a puzzle, and you need every piece of that puzzle, whether it's trying to work out whether a particular horse is going to win a race. And for that puzzle, you need to know, how fit is the horse? What has the horse been eating? What's its diet? Does the horse like ground to be dry or wet? You know, what are the running conditions? Is it going to favor that horse? You know, so, you know, anything that you're trying to predict, anything from a sporting match weather forecast to what's going to happen to the price of gold and silver or Bitcoin or your favorite S&P, you know, 500 stock, you know, it doesn't make any difference what you're forecasting. You've got to look at every single piece of evidence. And without every single piece of evidence, of course, you could be missing that crucial key piece. And that crucial key piece could be the thing that causes a very low probability event to happen. just, you know, just because something has only got a 1% chance of occurring doesn't mean it's not going to occur. You know, we saw some pretty impressive lightning strikes just in front of the White House, I think it was, a couple of days ago. And, you know, if you were trying to say what's the chance of lightning striking right in front of the White House, you would, you know, you'd have to say it's, you know, sort of one in a million or something. But that doesn't stop it happening, does it? And one in a million events or one in 100 events, whatever it is, they do happen. So you can't rule them out. And you have to look at every piece of the jigsaw puzzle to work out just how likely that is.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with that. Now, there's something else that's interesting about the profession of being a meteorologist, of being a weatherman, in that I've seen plenty of studies that show that when you can look at pretty much every domain that deals with the business of forecasting, the profession that has the highest degree of accuracy in their domain are weathermen, right? That it turns out that they're actually the best at predicting the quote-unquote future, but, and you'd know this better than I would, but the caveat to that is that meteorologists, weathermen, they tend to be accurate, let's say, 3 or 4 days out in a 10-day forecast. Whereas, right, the longer the time frame, the harder it gets to really understand sort of where the probabilities would change. And to your point about the different pieces of evidence, the issue, especially when it comes to the weather and in markets, using the two similarly, issue is that the shape of the pieces can be changing constantly.
Yeah, exactly. And although people like to, you know, poke fun at weather forecasters saying, you know, they can't forecast the weather or whatever, when you actually look at the statistics, particularly in the last 30 or 40 years, and this is part of the issue, you know, people are sort of a little bit stuck in the past when, yeah, okay, so weather forecasters were probably right about as often as they were wrong. But over the last 30 or 40 years, with the advent of supercomputing, day after day after day after day, you know, weather forecasters, and here in the UK, we have a particularly difficult time for forecasting the weather because we're surrounded by ocean. We get weather systems coming at us across the Atlantic. We get extreme heat coming at us from the continent. We get droughts, we get heat waves, we get snow, we get wind, we get every type of weather here. So it's very, very difficult to forecast. And yet more than 8 times out of 10 and nearer to sort of 9 times out of 10, the forecasts are very, very accurate to within a high degree of accuracy. So that skill, which is what it's called, the skill factor, how often the forecast is correct, is improving markedly over time. And you're quite right to say that out of all the sort of professions around the world that use forecasting, meteorologists are the ones that are kind of leading the way in terms of accuracy and improvements to skill. And if you try and, for example, compare it to economic forecasters, official economic forecasts, then you'll see that those are very often pretty dire. Why that is, I'm not entirely sure. Perhaps it's because there's an element of bias involved, and those making the forecasts are continually trying to sort of predict that things are going to return to normal. So you always get these forecasts that are constantly sort of returning, you know, interest rates back to 1 or 2% and you know, all the economic figures back to where they ought to be. Well, that's not how it works, of course. So when you get chaos in a system and things start to sort of shake themselves apart, then you get these wild swings in price. And you can spot that using weight of evidence techniques and a lot of the techniques that we use in meteorology. For example, ensemble forecasting. And I just wanted to mention this so that people can kind of get this in their mind, because these are the techniques that we're using at North Star Bad Charts, and any kind of technical analyst that is doing it properly should be doing this. So ensemble forecasting is where you don't just produce one prediction for the future. You predict many, many times what is going to happen in a few days' time. So in the world of meteorology, we will take the current weather conditions and we will simulate what's going to happen over the next few days in our computer models. And there are occasions when all of the computer models and all of the runs that we do in the computer are saying the same thing, you know, i.e. that it's going to be hot and sunny, for example. And when they're all pointing the same direction, then that gives you a high degree of confidence and you know that your forecast is very likely to be right. There are other occasions when the atmosphere is very chaotic and there's a lot going on, where the computer models and computer predictions for what's going to be happening 2, 3, 4 days ahead are kind of all pointing in different directions. And that's because chaos is starting to sort of take over during the forecast sequence between now and 3 or 4 days' time. And then in that situation, as a forecaster, you have to get across that level of uncertainty, that degree of uncertainty, and you have to express that to the listening public in a way that they can understand and make useful decisions regardless. So it's the same with you know, forecasting the markets and forecasting economics and forecasting, you know, the price of gold and silver. There are times when you can be very confident. And that confidence comes from, you know, get all these pieces of evidence pointing in the same direction. You know, we look at, you know, 30-year yields, we look at 10-year yields, we look at the real yield, we look at what's going on with the gold to silver ratio, you know, we'll look at what's going on with a wide number of markets and ratios between the S&P and precious metals, or between precious metals and commodities. And you can spot these shifts in capital flows. So all these little pieces of evidence and technical evidence on the chart itself as well, they kind of build up a big picture. And that big picture is what allows us to either have a high degree of confidence in what we're saying, or at times a low degree of confidence. So if an analyst isn't willing to admit that there are times when confidence is low, then they're kind of kidding themselves, and they're kidding the people that are following them on social media or wherever they're following them, you know, YouTube or whatever. So it's very, very important to be honest about that, and to be honest about the fact that the future is made up of probabilities, and it's not always 100% certain what's going to happen in the future.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
Right, I need to have that multiple roll of the die for the probabilities to be visible over time. If something happens more often than not, you need to have roughly the same set of conditions repeated over time to see what the true odds are of something happening. Now, the problem with markets, of course, is that, you know, it's not as scientific, you can argue, right? There's always more variables. There's a degree of sort of chaos theory and element to market movement. And there is the complicating factor that while one can be confident about something maybe happening on the macro front, if you are limited to a particular opportunity set, it could be that the probabilities might favor the macro setup playing out, but the opportunity set is not in and of itself also acting the way historically it should in those periods. So really what I'm referring to there, for example, is this kind of hellish environment that's happened the first 6 months of this year, where, you know, usually when you're in these high volatility periods for equities, money goes into the quote unquote safety of government treasuries, right, on the 30-year long duration side. So you could have been right in a thesis being risk off, but obviously this year, given the way treasuries have behaved, that didn't pan out the way historically would. So what I'm arguing basically is that the real complication for markets versus meteorology is that you almost have to have there's a joint hypothesis issue. If you're going to make an argument that you're going to be in a declining market, and then the other hypothesis is that treasuries behave off of that, and sometimes that doesn't quite work.
Yeah, and correlation isn't causation, which is, you know, very much kind of a well-known fact. So just because, you know, a particular correlation is taking place, it doesn't necessarily mean that that is what's causing a particular event to happen. So you have to cross-reference every moving part of what's happening. And the biggest mistake that is very often made, to be honest, is that people will look back over the last 10, 20, 30 years, 40 years, whatever, and they'll make assumptions about what's happening now based on what's happened over the last few decades. And that's a fatal flaw to make, because just because a particular set of circumstances has behaved in a certain way over the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years doesn't mean that that relationship is going to carry on in exactly the same way. And what I mean by that is, for example, and I suppose what I'm referring to is when we have what some people call a paradigm shift. And a paradigm shift is another way of sort of phrasing that, is a changing of the guard, a complete flipping of the norm, or what has become the norm, if you like. So, for example, you know, interest rates have been very much declining, and inflation as well has been very much on the decline since 1980. And we've been in this era of disinflation. In other words, inflation, but reducing inflation, and relatively strong global economies. And that's been great. You know, in that particular paradigm, there's a set of relationships that work, and you can, you know, they're pretty predictable. And when one thing happens, another thing happens, and that leads to another thing happening. And it's happened over and over again for the last 40, 50 years. But when you get these paradigm shifts and something fundamental changes, then you cannot look at what's been going on over the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years to try and extrapolate what's going to happen in the future. So during the 1970s, 60s and 70s, we were, you know, tracking, for example, the 10-year yield, and the 10-year yield was rising. Yields were rising, interest rates were rising. And the entire movement during the 60s and 70s was characterized by a rising support line. yields and interest rates were going up on top of a rising support line. They hit a peak in 1980 and began to decline. And then from 1980 to where we are now, the last 40 years, it's been characterized by a declining resistance line. So that's another paradigm. So we shifted from 10-year yields being supported by a rising trend line going up to 10-year yields being capped by a declining resistance line coming down. Now, that's two clearly identifiable paradigms or two different eras of monetary policy, monetary outcomes, economic outcomes. And the interesting thing to note, of course, is that the 10-year yield broke out above that declining resistance line pretty recently and is now above that. So when it got above around about 3% or thereabouts, it broke out above the resistance line. So that put us in a different paradigm. We've back-tested that breakout, but we still remain above that level and trending upwards on top of a rising support line. So that's just one piece of evidence, one bit of the jigsaw puzzle that's telling us as analysts that we are quite likely now to be in a different regime and that relationships in the economy and in finances are perhaps more akin to the 1960s and 70s than they are to the 1980s. Onwards.
Yeah, no, I think that's spot on. And the dilemma this year in particular has been in that relationship of treasuries to stocks, that you've never had a period where in very deep drawdowns, even in the 60s and 70s, even in that regime, where treasuries did not at least substantially outperform, meaning long duration, something like TLT would be down less, right? So, but this is kind of an interesting discussion to go through on this point about regime shifts and paradigm shifts, because I've had people say, well, you know, if the environment has changed, why wouldn't you reoptimize or change your approach or change your strategy? My response is always, well, the problem is that assumes that the paradigm persists, that you actually don't go back to the way things were, which is also a forecast, right? Ironically, when you kind of think about it, which means it has its own issues. So since you brought up this idea of paradigm shifts and changes that can happen, you're looking at things very technically, but if you're in what seems to be some kind of paradigm shift, do you start changing up the way that you're looking at different charts? Do you start thinking about things in a different way? Or do you say to yourself, this might be an anomaly, which is what I've been arguing, you know, first 6 months of the year. And the last thing you want to do is make a change based on an outlier.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, to that point about, you know, is this just effectively a little bit of an anomaly, and is what's happening within the normal range or the expected range of what we might expect to see? And there's a number of things that point to that perhaps not being the case. And there are economic indicators, for example, like the PPI, the CPI, and in large economies in the world, Germany, for example, which is the powerhouse of the European Union. And, you know, if Germany starts to have problems, then the entire European bloc, EU bloc, trading bloc will have serious issues. And for example, the PPI in Germany is beyond the peak of the 1970s. And it's, in fact, it's beyond the post-World War II peak, which was even higher than the 1970s. So that's at a truly historic, never before seen level. And when you start to see charts breaking out to levels that have never been seen in the last half a century or the last century, you start to, you know, sit up and take notice. Here in the UK, for example, gas and electricity prices are beyond anything that is even vaguely normal. You know, we've seen wholesale gas and electricity prices double and then double again. You know, we've got home energy bills in the UK moving from around £1,000 a year to around £4,000 a year. You know, that's a very large chunk of, you know, someone that's on the minimum wage, that's going to be around about 25 or 30% of their income just gone on heating their home. And so these kind of situations start to add up, and these little bits of the jigsaw puzzle, and you start to think, well, where else can I look to confirm that this is, you know, getting much more serious? You're talking about the S&P, and the S&P hasn't yet completely confirmed that we're in serious trouble here. The S&P has a rising support line that is somewhere around about 3,700, something like that. We're currently sitting at just over 4,000, aren't we? 4,100 and something. So the S&P is in a bearish rising wedge technically at the moment. So the chart pattern that has formed on the S&P since June of this year is a bearish rising wedge that is moving towards its upper resistance line, which is currently somewhere around about 4,350, that kind of area. So in an ever tightening range. So it looks technically as though the S&P is more likely than not to break to the downside sometime between now and September, late August, early September. Now, if that technical chart plays out and we cross that threshold at around about, well, by then it'll be somewhere just below 4,000, then that's a very large piece of the puzzle starting to fall into place there. And these are reflected in the ratio charts. When you look at a ratio of S&P to gold, for example, or you look at a chart that compares, you know, general equities to commodities or to silver or to platinum or any of those kind of things, you can see these kind of capital shifts, these large-scale movements of capital from one sector to another as the ratio chart begins to swing in the opposite direction. And then you can see the same thing with cryptocurrencies as well. You know, the cryptocurrency ratio charts are looking very unpromising for the next few months or even the next few years. But so, and you know, of course, the cryptocurrencies have never had to deal with a long-term decline in the Nasdaq, for example. And the cryptocurrencies haven't yet proven that they're going to behave differently to tech stocks. They may do. They may sort of decouple and become some kind of store of value. And they may be, you know, there may be a huge uptake in cryptocurrencies that sort of kind of leads cryptos away from the Nasdaq if the Nasdaq breaks down even more and the S&P breaks down. So, but what I'm saying is that we haven't had cryptocurrencies set against a long-term sort of bear market or sideways moving stock market. And when I say that, what I'm referring to is kind of the kind of thing that happened in the 1970s, of course, where stocks went nowhere for a decade, as gold doubled and then doubled again and doubled again and then doubled again. So, you know, we're starting to get the pieces of evidence and the bits of the jigsaw puzzle starting to fall into place that are tentatively pointing to that kind of an era developing. Of course, that'd be a huge shock for investors. And if that were to happen and be confirmed, then that will be a huge changing of the guard.
So I'm glad you mentioned that point about essentially the sample size in terms of cryptocurrencies being tested in bear markets, because there have been a lot of narratives making assumptions that cryptocurrencies would behave in a certain way in more volatile periods. And time again, it's been proven to your point that it's more correlated to the Nasdaq. But, you know, when you're a meteorologist, you have, you know, tremendous data and you have tremendous history. When you have markets and in particular new asset classes, you really don't. And by the way, that also means to your point that, yeah, maybe cryptocurrencies do end up diverging at some point. But technically speaking, they're still kind of looking like charts of any sort of tech stock. So you treat it as such until something maybe structurally happens. I don't know what that would be fundamentally, but you know, there's always a sort of issue of what's the causation of why cryptocurrencies are behaving like Nasdaq stocks. And to me, the causation is always leverage and over-optimism.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
Yeah, I mean, we just don't know yet, because cryptocurrencies haven't got that history going back to the 1970s to compare. But the Nasdaq is in a declining, expanding wedge pattern, which when it breaks to the upside is very, very bullish, of course. But we're just reaching the resistance line now. Somewhere around 13,600 is where the resistance is. We're sitting at about 13,200 on the Nasdaq 100 index. So it's looking extended. It's had quite a strong move from somewhere around about 11,000 up to where it is now, over 13,000. So my expectation would be for a resumption of the downtrend sometime in the next sort of 2 or 3, 4 weeks as we move down, sort of as we move towards September, October time. My initial expectation is for a bottom in the cryptocurrencies towards the end of this year or in the early part of next year. But that's on the assumption that the cycles that have been in place up until now, for Bitcoin in particular, because that's the one that's been around the longest, it's under the assumption that these cycles continue to play out, and we just don't know if that's going to be the case. So I would urge caution on any particular assumptions about cryptocurrencies beyond the end of this year. And the all-important thing, of course, is that when you have a technical downtrend, nothing changes until you break through the downtrend resistance line as prices fall in Nasdaq, S&P, you know, Bitcoin, whatever it happens to be. The price chart forms a resistance line on the way down. And as long as you're below that resistance line and you're below the 30-week moving average, you're below the 200-day moving average, there's nothing to do as an investor. You know, you're taking a big risk if you're trying to sort of catch the bounces in a declining sort of bear market. Other than shorting it from the top, you know, the breakdown at the top, then anything is risky in a bear market at this stage, because we're getting closer to what ought to be, perhaps historically speaking with Bitcoin, the point where we start to see things turning around. My forecast when we broke down below the sort of 35,000-40,000 level was that we would probably get down to around about 12,000. We're bouncing at the 20,000 level at the moment. We've bounced up a little bit, but it looks like a bearish bounce. And I still suspect that we probably are heading down to somewhere around 10,000-12,000. But until we get that breakout, until we're back above the 200-day moving average, you just stay away from it. Why? You know, why sort of scratch your head trying to work out, you know, someone you've heard on YouTube, someone said this, someone said that. It doesn't really matter what anybody says until you get that confirmed technical breakout, because the chart just isn't reflecting it. So look elsewhere. Look at sectors that are doing well. Uranium, for example, you know, uranium miners. There are plenty of areas where you can, you know, invest at the moment and be making good sums of money. So, you know, find those winners in the ratio charts. You know, you can look at the ratio charts and plot, you know, gold against platinum, or platinum against silver, or gold against uranium, and you can find the winners in those ratio charts and increase the odds, increase the probabilities of being on the right side of the bet. And I did mention platinum there, which is just worth repeating as well, because if you're into precious metals, platinum is historically undervalued at the moment, and the ratio chart is starting to look quite interesting for platinum.
Everybody that's here, again, please make sure you follow Kevin on Twitter, and obviously check out his website for his deeper research. You know, we can talk about that a little bit later in the space here. And again, my name is Michael Guy, publisher of Lead Lag Report. So, Kevin, I've done a lot of work with the CMT Association, Chartered Market Technicians Association. And one of the guys who I've known for a long time made a point to me that usually the number of people that will try to go after the CMT designation that want to be technicians, they tend to come out of the woodworks after a massive bear market. Because the perception is that, you know, if you really want to manage risk, you have to be a chartist, you have to be aware of some of these intermarket relationships. How do you think about the school of thought of technical analysis? Because I think a lot of people, in my opinion, focus more on the idea that it's the way to make a lot of money, whereas it may end up actually being more about not losing as much.
Yes. And just as important, of course, and you'll know this, Michael, is careful risk and money management. Because if you're doing it right, you can have more than half of your trades not working. In other words, getting stopped out of more than half of your trades, but you can still see your portfolio growing. And, you know, that is through using this kind of technical analysis, because you need to identify which are the investments that are carrying the greatest kind of risk to reward benefits, and which are the ones that are showing the greatest amount of evidence that they are indeed on the cusp or already starting to move up in their bull market. Of course, as a stock or a sector or an ETF begins to move from bearish to bullish, it typically forms a basing pattern and then gradually starts to build the bullish evidence as price moves up. Now, as an investor, you're always going to be thinking, well, I want to get in at the bottom. Well, that is, you know, that is difficult even with technical analysis, because you need to start to see some evidence building that this chart, whatever it is means business. So it needs to get above some key moving averages. It needs to get above some key horizontal breakout levels, and it needs to be performing strongly against other sectors. So the ratio charts of this particular, whatever it is you're talking about, against other sectors needs to be looking favorable. And of course, the longer you wait for evidence to come in, the less of the move you're going to catch. So there's a sweet spot for entering into these trades.
That's a really important point too, by the way, just to hit on that, because that's it, in other words, you need to have, so yes, you want to have the weight of the evidence in your favor, but you don't want the weight to be too heavy, right? Because to your point, a good amount of the move might occur. I always make this point that, you know, everyone always says you never want to catch a falling knife, but the reality is the biggest returns come at the turn.
Exactly. And by using very careful risk and money management, you can take smaller positions in the stocks that are a bit like catching a falling knife, and you've got a strong hunch, if you want to put it that way, or to use the technical analysis, you've got some initial pieces of evidence starting to come in that this stock is likely to be close to the bottom of the bear market. So, but in that position, you don't yet have the evidence. So you would maybe take risk, maybe 0.25% of your NAV on a trade like that. And then as it starts to build its evidence, you can start thinking about, 0.5% or 1% of your NAV on a particular trade once you've got stronger evidence. And over time, you'll find that the trades with the stronger evidence are the ones that are more reliable because they've got that strong evidence. But of course, you do inevitably miss out on some of that early part of the move. So it's a balance. But by doing it that way, you're able to see half of your trades or even more than half of your trades not working, because the ones that don't work are the ones that have, less evidence. So, but you've taken a smaller position in those. So that, doesn't damage your portfolio so much. And the ones that have the more evidence, greater amount of evidence, okay, you're accepting the fact that you have missed a bit of the move, or in some cases quite a chunk of the move, but you've got more evidence and you're more confident and you're much more likely that that trade is going to play out and that you're going to get the measured move and that you're going to be able to, make maybe a 50% to 100% gain on that particular investment. Okay, so you might have been able to make a 500% gain if you caught it right at the very bottom, but it's a question of, risk tolerance and risk and reward. But this goes back to my training as a meteorologist, because a lot of what I did was working with the Royal Air Force in the UK and working with the blue light services, the emergency services, and providing them with risk analysis information around severe weather events, around 100 mile an hour winds or flooding and having to evacuate people from towns and cities and all that kind of stuff. So a lot of what I did wasn't really weather forecasting. It was disaster, working with the disaster relief agencies. So that kind of risk and reward and risk and benefit analysis is really important in investing if you want to avoid making some big mistakes. And, seeing all of this in context and seeing the markets in context is, it's not an easy thing to do. And it takes a lot of time if you're going to do it properly, but it is worth it in the end.
No, and actually that point about the disaster relief agencies is interesting, because I've long argued this, and the data supports, I put out research around this idea that when you look at what most people think of as trend indicators, let's focus on the moving average for a moment. It's not that moving averages tell you necessarily that stocks are likely to go up or likely to go down. It's more that it tells you about volatility dynamics. So usually when you're above a 20-day, 50-day, 200-day moving average, the volatility of what you're tracking is lower above its moving average than when it's below its moving average. And that's important because, to your point about the sort of disaster situations and the weather, if you're below moving average, you're more likely to have a tail event, more likely to have a very extreme crash, correction, bear market, because you're already moving around violently. Right? I think a lot of technicians I see on Twitter maybe perhaps mistake the idea of trying to make money because of an uptrend versus trying to avoid high volatility scenarios, which are likely to cause them to have big losses.
Yeah. Yeah, you're quite right, and that kind of trade-off between volatility and evidence and risk and reward and sound risk and money management is not easy to strike the right balance at all. But if you can put the odds in your favor by correctly identifying one way of explaining it is like this. If you're going to, someone recommends you a stock and they say, this stock's great, it could be, let's say a gold miner, great management, everything's great, everything's looking fantastic. They've got a good, good mine that's bringing out good quality gold or whatever. That's fundamental story is great. But if the market is going against you, so if we're in a precious metals bear market, say it's 2014, 2013, then no matter how good the mining company is, no matter how low their all-in sustaining cost is for getting the metal out of the ground, that particular stock has got a real headwind against it because the rest of the market is going down. So if you haven't correctly identified what the ETFs are doing, GDX, HUI, GDXJ, the ETFs in the sector, then you're already missing a huge part of what you need in order to put the odds in your favor. If you take a position in 2013 in a good gold miner, you would have probably just waited, 6, 7, 8 years to get back to where you started, because you would have lost a load of money and then had to wait a very long time to get back to where you started. So, and that's if the mining company didn't go bankrupt in the process. So don't, what I'm saying there is, don't fight the trend. Don't, you know, let the trend be your friend, and correctly identify whether you're actually in a bull market or a bear market, or where you are in the economic cycle for that particular sector. And that's key to at least putting, you know, the wind behind you, the wind in your sails, rather than fighting against the tide. And then you can start looking at the detail, then you start looking at ratio charts, and then you start looking at, you know, moving averages and support lines, resistance lines, and all the rest of it. And another thing to point out here is currencies, and the US dollar index in particular, which I just wanted to touch on, because the US dollar index and how that relates to the markets and particularly precious metals is very much misunderstood, I think, because the DXY, which everybody, and if you go on my Twitter feed, you'll see me in the last couple of days trying to really hammer this point home, because I want people to understand it. The DXY, people often just say the dollar index, or sometimes people make a big mistake and just call it the dollar. But the DXY is just an index that compares the US dollar to primarily the euro, also the British pound, the Canadian dollar, Japanese yen, a couple of others, but primarily the euro. So it's the US dollar index is effectively the US dollar euro pair. Now, and half a dozen other currencies. So the number that comes out of the US dollar index is currently about 106. If you just pause and think for a moment, what does that mean? Since the 1970s, the US dollar index has oscillated between about 70 and 165, was it? Something like that. But it's been contained within that range, bouncing up and down, you know, typically between about 70 and 100 recently, 70 and 120, that kind of range. So, and that number comes out of the fact that the US dollar index recently has been gaining some strength against the euro. So that number has risen from 90 to 100 to 106. But if you zoom out a little bit and realize that since 2008, roughly, I think it is, the US dollar index has moved up from around about 72 to 107 since 2008. Now, gold has moved up in the same time period from $850 to $1,850. So gold has more than doubled in price, in inverted commas, whilst the US dollar index has moved from just over 70 to over 100. So context is everything. And why is that? Yeah, why is gold going up over those years, despite the fact that the US dollar index has gone up 30% or whatever it is, more than 30%? And the answer is inflation, of course. So the US dollar index is a whole load of currencies jumping up and down against each other, trying to prove which one's got the biggest balls, if you pardon my French. And they're just jumping up and down, you know, taking in turns to jump higher in a box. But the box is dropping like a rock. It's like an elevator going down because of inflation. Inflation is raging outside of the box, and all these currencies are jumping up and down against each other inside the box to try and prove which one's got, you know, which one's strongest. But it's all relative against each other. It's not taking into account what's going on outside the box. And when you've got inflation, I mean, here in the UK, we're heading for 13% inflation for the next year, apparently, and quite possibly more than that. So if you've got inflation raging like that, then it doesn't really matter what the currencies are doing against each other. If you've got a good barometer to measure the economy and what's going on, and gold acts as a barometer over time, then you would expect that barometer to flash red. In other words, for the DXY to not, in the long term, have much impact on what's going on with precious metals. So those kind of direct relationships that people make assumptions about, so DXY is going up, so therefore gold has got to go down, you have to question those and actually look at the evidence. Don't just, you know, accept the rumor. Don't just, you know, a lot of these are just like old wives' tales, you know, it's kind of like gossip and it's just not true. So over a very short time frame, yes, a rising US dollar index puts pressure on gold over a very short time frame because of the way traders react to it and the way the market reacts to it. But over a longer time frame, DXY going up is not stopping the strength of gold. And that should be a very strong warning signal for everybody.
Yeah, no, and that's a really, you and I think similarly in terms of that cynicism around these kind of old wives' tales, these kind of one-liners that people say, oh, you know, gold is strong because the dollar is weak, or gold is strong because the dollar is strong. And you know, you can actually test this, right? You can actually see from a backtest perspective, run correlations, do all kinds of statistical analysis. And it's already been done before, right? In the case of gold, the reality is very few things can explain gold's movement, except usually high volatility periods in equities. There tends to be kind of a flight to safety trade that happens on average, kind of like treasuries, although obviously that didn't work as well this year. But that I think argues that gold is perhaps the ultimate diversifier no matter what, right, in a portfolio, because if it doesn't co-move with everything else, then that's sort of the very definition of having a more robust portfolio. But let's go back to this point of the dollar, because I've made this argument for several months that the way the dollar has been running and the way the volatility has been picking up in currencies across the board, it's almost as if there's some sense of a sovereign debt crisis coming. And it's hard to see that in charts for equities, but if you look at charts for currencies, you know, historically, these kind of big sovereign debt crises tend to first show themselves in extreme currency movement. I'm just curious, when you look at the global landscape, you look at all this currency volatility, does that make you worry, right, that something nefarious might be coming? Or do you say to yourself, you know what, it's going to somehow be reflected in the charts, and that's how you're going to adjust your thesis or your conclusions?
Yeah. So,
right? In other words, kind of like, you know, it's one chart more important than the other. That's sort of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, I think it's what the story that the charts are telling collectively that is what is causing me particular concern. If you kind of clear your mind for a moment and just think about the US dollar index, and I mentioned inflation, and you can actually plot the US dollar index against inflation. You can use the PPI as a proxy, PPI as a proxy for inflation. So you can do a chart of DXY over PPI. And that is very, very different. And what it displays is effectively the loss of purchasing power of all the currencies within the US dollar index. So I appreciate the fact that the rates of inflation are different in each of the constituent currencies that make up the DXY. But in broad terms, the euro and the US dollar are suffering from high levels of inflation at the moment. So they're both losing purchasing power at a rapid rate. I've already sort of explained that DXY is primarily or essentially the US dollar versus the euro in a straight out kind of battle, one against the other, but with both losing out to inflation. So regardless of how the dollar goes up against the euro, or perhaps one day the euro starts to show a little bit of strength against the dollar, regardless of that, they're both losing to inflation. So, you know, there's a bigger guy out there than the dollar, and a bigger guy out there than the euro. And that is inflation at the moment, which is running rampant and eating away at everybody's purchasing power whilst we're all distracted by this US dollar index and the kind of misnomer that it is gaining strength. You know, they say plot it against inflation, and rather than going up, the chart is going down, and the chart has been going down since inception in the 1970s. So, you know, the US dollar index versus inflation is quite the opposite to what the DXY is. So, you know, it's a question of it's a question of context, and it's a question of how you view the world and how you view these relationships and how realistic you want to be about the information that you're actually looking at. You know, you can look at it in a very simplistic sense and just kind of accept the kind of stories that we're told, or you can actually pull up a chart and look at the evidence for yourself and see quite clearly that a lot of the assumptions that are sort of made and a lot of the stories that are told about relationships between, you know, the dollar and precious metals or whatever it happens to be are in fact not correct, or at least not correct all the time. And particularly when you get a sort of a change of regime. Now, what's going on in the world at the moment is reflecting in the charts, of course, and the charts are looking very, very worrying to me at the moment in a number of respects. And I think the key chart to look at really is the S&P, because if the S&P breaks that level that I mentioned earlier and begins to break down, then that's very, very strong evidence that something else is going on here that is outside the normal realms of, you know, sort of a normal sort of bear market in the S&P, a normal sort of bear market in NASDAQ. You know, there's a big difference between that and the type of event that we saw in the 1970s through the 1980s where stock markets just went absolutely nowhere for a very long time, which explains why, of course, we saw those huge capital shifts into precious metals, and gold, you know, went up from $50 to, you know, almost $1,000. So, you know, can we see those kind of percentage gains in precious metals again? Well, maybe not quite that much. I don't know. But, you know, to see these, you know, just a small amount of what's currently invested in global equity markets moving towards hard assets would, yeah, I mean, the implications of that are, you know, profound for everybody and for all of us, you know?
Yeah, and I've made this point that, you know, this probably looked more like a bear market relief rally, and it can continue, obviously, but yeah, there's still the sort of longer term overhang, especially of housing probably coming back into line. But I want to go back to uranium for a moment, since you mentioned it. And you know, I've had a number of uranium experts on prior spaces making the longer term fundamental case. I just pulled up the Global X Uranium ETF, URA, which tracks uranium itself, and you know, had a long period of nothingness, then, you know, surge, and then kind of some just broad volatility back and forth, back and forth. Let's talk about the weight of the evidence when it comes to the uranium thesis, because it sounds to me like you believe that this is sort of a longer term way to make conceivably some big return, but how you get there is going to be maybe a challenge.
Yeah, sure. So those that follow me on Twitter will remember that I recommended getting into uranium stocks in 2019 and 2020 when the breakout occurred, and the URA ETF that you're talking about there broke out around about the middle of 2020 above a key resistance line, declining resistance line. And the chart patterns that were forming, I won't try and describe them verbally on here. It helps when you have the chart in front of you, but effectively it's forming a typical basing pattern with all of the indicators that you need to have a high degree of confidence that a large move was coming. The Global X ETF went from around about $11 or $12 to around about $30 or more. So it more than doubled over the course of, I don't know what it was, a year, 18 months, something like that. And since then, we've seen a controlled and gradual pullback in consolidation. We're sitting somewhere around about $21, I think, at the moment. And the indicators are starting to show the probability of an upside move developing, but we haven't got all of the evidence in yet to be certain that the low for this pullback is in place. I'd initially said that the pullback could come all the way back to around about $15. I think the lowest we got was around about 18, and it's probably occurred a little bit earlier than I expected as well. I was looking at maybe $15 during the perhaps Q1 of next year, something like that. So, but if we do see the breakout, and if the Global X URA ETF moves above about $26, then that will be sufficient to break out through the declining resistance line. Then that will signal that the next sort of big move is underway. And some of the individual uranium miners are already breaking out and back above their 30-week moving averages. So my approach to the uranium sector has been to buy that breakout and then add on weakness. So I haven't sold any of my uranium positions. I've just kind of reorganized some of them. And so it's a case of buy, hold, and add on weakness for me, because the targets are much higher. Fundamentally, there's a lot in favor of the uranium markets, as long as we don't get a nuclear meltdown over in Ukraine there as a result of what's going on with one of the world's largest nuclear reactors being used as some kind of a shield by the Russians, I think. But that kind of black swan aside, then the fundamental case for uranium is looking very, very strong with everything that's going on, of course, and the issues that are, you know, we're seeing around the world in energy security. And nuclear does provide a very strong case for providing that kind of energy security.
And it doesn't sound to me like you think that necessarily that needs oil prices to keep running higher or stay elevated, because I think there's a perception out there that uranium is maybe almost like a call option on an oil spike, right? It's a lot of alternatives, I would argue, tend to be seen. It sounds to me like you believe it almost doesn't matter what oil prices might do longer term. There's sort of a longer term play anyway there.
Yeah, oil's interesting. I've been tracking the oil chart since it broke out back in early 2021 at around about $60 or so, and followed it as it moved up to around about $130. It's oil for me is still looking pretty bullish, because it broke out from a very long-term sort of wedge pattern, declining wedge that was forming for the best part of 20 years, nearly 20 years, over 15 years anyway. And that breakout signaled that something, you know, something big was, you know, about to happen. You know, when you get these sort of patterns that form over decades, when you get a breakout of that pattern, it's, you know, it's sending a strong signal to the markets. Okay. When you get those kind of multi-decade breakouts, and I suspect oil, once this little pullback is done, is finding some support in the region between about $90 and $110. But I suspect that we are not done yet with the move higher in oil prices. But regardless of that, you know, the case for uranium is very, very strong. And you can again, use the ratio charts of oil to uranium or oil to the S&P or whatever to try and, you know, help to inform your decisions around, you know, which sectors you should be investing in. So, you know, whether you should be investing in oil producers, explorers, or whether you should be looking at, you know, uranium miners and all that kind of thing. And I have to be honest, looking at the uranium charts and plotting uranium against other forms of investment, I've yet to find anything that beats the prospects of uranium. So I am very, very bullish on the case for uranium, regardless of what happens to the oil price.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great way to frame it. So listen, we're coming up at the top of the hour. Everyone that's here, please make sure you follow Kevin and check out his research on his website. For those, Kevin, who are kind of curious to learn more about the kind of research you offer, just maybe do a little elevator pitch on the site, what kind of research you do, just anything to kind of help the audience a little bit here.
Yeah, if you like the idea of this kind of weight of evidence-based technical approach where, you know, we try and examine every bit of the puzzle and put it all together in a coherent way, then yeah, we're at northstarbadcharts.com is the website, northstarbadcharts.com. And you can find me, Kevin Wadsworth, and I'm at North Star Charts on Twitter. And also you can get North Star Bad Charts on YouTube as well. So we've got lots of videos and interviews and that kind of thing on our YouTube channel. So please do seek that out and subscribe and yeah, take a look there.
And everyone that's here, thank you for joining us. Again, please make sure you follow Kevin. And everybody, if I don't see you, enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you, Kevin. I do appreciate it.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at LeadLag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the LeadLag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.